So after Jesus was born, the angels went back to heaven, the shepherds returned to their flocks, and the Magi went back to whatever it is that Magi do. And that pretty much just left Jesus with Mary and Joseph and life as normal. And so as the glory of that Christmas faded, they did have to deal with some challenges, of course. We know that they feared for their lives, and that must have been a really scary ordeal, as they feared that Herod might kill Jesus, and he did try. So they went to Egypt for 2 years. And so Mary and Joseph lived there. I imagine they had no family. They lived as strangers in this foreign land, and I'm sure that was challenging. They were not wealthy people. They did receive those gifts, the gold, frankincense, and myrrh, which are valuable. I don't know that they pawned them right away. And they might have had to go to Egypt and live there for a little while. It's hard to really know or tell what they did. But life went back to normal. When they left Egypt, they came back. They didn't want to settle in Judea where Herod's son was ruling. So they went to Nazareth in Galilee. And Nazareth is a very, very small place. History's almost forgotten it. The only reason we remember it at all is because of Jesus. If not for Jesus, we would never talk about Nazareth. It was a small town in a small province that didn't really matter in the Roman Empire. And that's where Jesus grew up. Probably from about age 2 and on, that's where he lived. And he would have lived in a house that looked something like that, stone house, only a few windows. These houses were dark, confining. You tried to spend as much time as you could outside. The houses were dusty, often smelly. So you would have spent time in the courtyard. You would have done a lot of your work out there, your cooking. They probably did prayers on the roof. The roof was a very functional thing in these houses. And so I imagine that when Jesus was a kid, he spent a fair amount of time up on that roof praying. Not because he was a super religious person that we know of, necessarily, but just because he was Jewish, and that's what they would have done. It's hard to know what Jesus knew about himself. The early church speculated a lot about how Jesus' divine nature interacted with his human nature. They argued about this. They called each other heretics over it. I don't want to go down that road today. It's almost too confusing, and they have all these like dense philosophical terms to try to understand. But Jesus was, in as far as we can tell, normal. And it's hard for a lot of people to believe that Jesus could have gone from somebody just eating these like sort of basic dishes, these meat stews with bread and olives in these flat earthenware kind of vessels, that he went from just this normal guy doing that to becoming a carpenter, to all of a sudden, when he was baptized by John, the light bulb goes off, and all of a sudden he's like the Son of God, he's doing miracles. It's hard for people to understand or to kind of wrap their minds that he could go from such a normal person to such a supernatural kind of person. And so people have speculated a lot about Jesus' childhood. The Gospels don't tell us anything, really. They tell us about one little episode when Jesus was 12. His family takes him to Jerusalem during the Passover. And Jesus gets lost. You probably know this story. He gets lost. Mary thinks he's with Joseph. Joseph thinks he's with Mary. Or they think he's with other people in their family in this caravan of pilgrims. And they find that Jesus is nowhere to be found, that he's actually back in the temple. And he's discussing these great matters of theology and faith with the Jewish rabbis, who are amazed that this 12-year-old knows so much. I don't know that you would consider it supernatural knowledge that he exhibits. It's certainly impressive, but that's really the only picture we get of Jesus. And so what was Jesus like during these silent years, during these years that we have very little knowledge about? And I don't want to just speculate, you know, too much, because speculation gets you in trouble and often doesn't really yield that many benefits anyway. But there's really good reason to believe that Jesus was just normal, that he never did anything miraculous until he was much older. Now, of course, that's not what everybody said. They actually wrote, there was a gospel that was written in the 2nd or 3rd century. It's called the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. And this might surprise you that we didn't just have 4 gospels back then. There were dozens of gospels, maybe even over 100. Different perspectives, different people, and a lot of them were later than the ones that made the cut. So to make the cut, you had to be a little bit more authentic, a little bit more official, recognized, have a standing in the church. And there were a lot that were just that hit the editing room floor. It never made the final Bible. The Gospel, the infancy Gospel of Thomas was one of those. And you don't want the Jesus that this Gospel depicts. Because when Jesus was a kid, according to this Gospel, well, one thing he did was he made sparrows out of clay. Not just like Play-Doh sparrows that he went, ooh, like that with. Actual sparrows that he breathed life into and flew. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. And if I was a kid with like supernatural abilities, you better believe I'm going to show off. I'm going to do all kinds of stuff. So that's a pretty minor thing. But beyond like creating sparrows out of clay, Jesus straight up murders kids. Like when kids don't like Jesus or do something to him, Jesus just smites them, strikes them down. And it's funny because this gospel wasn't really written by critics or skeptics. It was what we consider a Gnostic gospel. And Gnosticism was this sort of strain of Christianity that was considered heretical. It's kind of too complicated to get into, but they had a very different spin on the gospel than the Orthodox Church had. And so I'm not sure why they depicted Jesus this way or what they were trying to accomplish, but suffice to say, you don't want their picture of the infant or the childhood Jesus. But I think there's better reason to believe that Jesus actually didn't do anything supernatural. Now, why do I say that? Am I just speculating? A little bit. But I do believe that if Jesus had exhibited these miraculous powers at an earlier age, people would have had a very different reaction to him when he was 30. So, for instance, the people in Nazareth, now this is Jesus' hometown, where he grew up for over 20 years. So when he goes back there after his ministry starts, and he's been performing miracles in places like Capernaum, and he's been teaching, and he's gaining a following. So he goes back to Nazareth. This is how they respond to him after he teaches in their synagogue. Where did this man get these things, they ask, these things as in these abilities, this ability to teach? What's this wisdom that has been given him? What are these remarkable miracles he's performing? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son and the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. So if you know that story in Nazareth, they actually get to a point where they want to throw Jesus off a cliff. So that didn't go very well. But why do they react so strongly? It seems a little weird. But again, it's like they grew up thinking this guy was this normal guy, and all of a sudden he's doing miracles. It doesn't make sense to them. I think that's why they're reacting this way. And I think if Jesus had shown miraculous abilities when he was 12 or 13, they'd be like, oh yeah, of course he's doing these things. This is what Jesus does. And they would have had a lot bigger buzz. So it's almost like they feel like he's been holding back on them. Like he could have done these things in their midst for all these years, and he didn't. So I'm not sure if that's the reason they react so strongly, but they have a hard time with this. But I think that reaction points to the fact that Jesus lived a pretty normal childhood. But that's not the only one. So this is from John chapter 7. But when the Jewish festival of Tabernacles was near, Jesus' brother said to him, "Leave Galilee and go to Judea, so that your disciples there may see the works you do. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you are doing these things, show yourself to the world." For even his own brothers did not believe in him. Now that little editorial comment by John, in some ways, doesn't make a lot of sense. If you just look at their words at face value, you think, well, I guess they believe in Jesus. They recognize that he's doing things, and they're just encouraging him. Hey, go to Jerusalem during this festival. Make yourself known. Let everybody see what you can do. But they're not saying it in a nice way, according to John. They're saying it in a way that is more cynical. It's like, you know, you want to be famous? Go be famous. If that's what you're trying to do. So Jesus' brothers, for some reason, don't believe in him at first. This is significant later when James, one of his brothers, becomes a leader in the church. He's one of the people who was sort of a critic of Jesus, and then he came to believe in Jesus after the resurrection. So it's a little bit hard to understand their reaction, but again, I think it supports the fact that he wasn't doing incredible things in their house. They had never seen Jesus like miraculously feed the family with a little scrap of bread or something like that. They had never seen that happen before. They had never seen him do anything that was beyond normal. And so it's almost like, where is this stuff coming from? Now, there might be some sibling rivalries at play. If you have siblings, you know that maybe there's a rivalry between you and them. I don't know. I didn't really have a rivalry with my brother. I was so much better than him, there was no rivalry that could happen. I only make these comments about my brother because sometimes he listens to my sermons. So this is like me talking trash to him, okay? I have a good relationship with him. But anyway, there could be some sibling rivalries at play here that maybe are complicating matters a little bit. But again, I think it supports the idea Jesus was normal. He was. He didn't really do anything that outlandish. The last reaction I want to look at is Mary's. It's not only Mary's reaction, so I do want to give that little sort of preface to it. But this is from Mark chapter 3. Then Jesus entered a house, and again a crowd gathered so that he and his disciples were not even able to eat. When his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, where they said, he's out of his mind. Now this could actually mean a few different things. And Mary is listed as one of the people in his family. It's his brothers, possibly his sisters too, and Mary's listed later in the chapter as being in this group. So we don't have a quote from her in particular, so I want to be careful what I ascribe to her as far as what she was thinking and feeling about this. But it's almost like they see Jesus doing this ministry, and they're surprised, shocked even, and they think this is unhealthy. They don't understand what he's doing. Now, look, this could all be about that Jesus isn't eating, because if you want to make your mother mad, you don't eat right, right? That's how you get a call from mom. You show you that you're not eating right, you're not taking care of yourself, mom's going to get a little upset about you, right? So maybe that's it. But I do wonder a little bit, because if anyone should have known about Jesus' identity, about his mission, about what he was going to be like, it really should have been Mary. You know, we have that song that we sing during Christmas time, Mary, Did You Know? And they go through all these things, Mary, did you know? And the answer to most of them is yes, Mary knew. She knew this. She had an angel tell her these things. Now, maybe she didn't know completely who Jesus was or that he was really God in human flesh. I'm not sure she understood that part of it. But she understood a lot, that Jesus was going to be the Messiah. So you kind of wonder, like, why would this surprise her that Jesus is now doing these things? Now, it could be, again, more the way in which he's going about doing it, that he's, like, you know, not eating, that he has these followers, that he's kind of a homeless guy. You know, he's not really your ideal, like, for what you want your kid to be, because he's not settled down. You know, he's not married. He has no kids of his own. He doesn't necessarily measure up to, especially the Jewish family ideal in those days. So maybe that's part of it. But I do wonder if Mary's faith, her belief, her knowledge in who Jesus was has been chipped away a little bit over time. Because remember, for 30 years, he was just her kid. I know there were angels. I know there were shepherds and wise men. But that was a long time ago. I have this little theory that it's not necessarily the hard times that crush our faith the most. It's the ordinary. Because I'm not saying that no one walks away from their faith because something tragic happened, because sometimes that does happen. But a lot of times when something bad happens to somebody, that actually galvanizes their faith. That brings them closer to God. They cling to their faith. They want to have God in their life because they feel like they can't go on without him. Now, you might not agree with this. It's my theory. You don't have to agree with it. But how many testimonies have you heard where someone talks about how they came back with God? It was not because something great happened. It was because something bad happened. I hear those testimonies a lot. And so I do feel like the one thing that can kind of sabotage our faith the most, it's just the ordinary, the mundaneness of life, the repetitiveness of life, that day after day, the sort of the same thing happens. So you know what depresses me? Dirty dishes. So we don't use the dishwasher in the house. I am the dishwasher. I'm the one who washes all the dishes, pots and pans, plates, silverware, all that stuff. And, you know, and one morning you wake up and you do the dishes and everything looks good. And a lot of times because of I do youth group or I do some other stuff, I don't get back late at night, and I come home, and I kind of walk past the darkened kitchen, and I see things rising out of the sink. I'm like, man, I just washed those. And I'm not saying it depresses me, as like I get depression about it, but it's one of those things that just kind of crushes you a little bit. You're like, oh, I got to do that again. And that's not the only thing. I mean, you could say work does that. You know, you get up Monday, here's another week of work. And then you go through, you get to the weekend, and there's another Monday. Oh, got to go back to school. Got to go back to work. And it kind of crushes us a little bit. Not, you know, like losing someone that you love, but it's hard on us as humans, I think. And Mary's gone through a lot of this with Jesus, and he's just been this normal kid. And I don't think life was easy for Mary and Joseph and their family. I don't think they lived extravagantly. I think they lived a very humble, simple, basic life. You know, for all that we emphasize about Jesus' humble beginnings and how big of a deal it was that he was born in a manger, I think you could argue it's a much bigger deal that he lives for like 28 years in Nazareth as a carpenter's son. That's more humbling, I think, than just being born in a manger. Because he's a baby. He doesn't even know what's going on. And then you got angels. So that kind of, you know, brought a little light to that moment. But, man, 28 years in this podunk little town, that's got to weigh on you a little bit. And so I wonder if Mary sort of, I don't say she lost her faith or she stopped believing, but if her knowledge is just a little bit weaker. You know, when things go far into the past, you sort of, they just don't seem as real anymore. So maybe you had an intense spiritual experience like 5 years ago or 10 years ago, and you kind of notice that each year that goes by, it takes away a little bit of the power of what happened in your mind. I think this is just what it is to be human. So I think all of these little snippets we get of people's reactions to Jesus, people who knew him in his childhood, they tell us that it's most probable that he never did anything miraculous. That he was just normal. Now, does that matter? In a sense, no, it doesn't matter at all. I'm just wasting your time, I guess. It doesn't really matter in the fact that he just started doing miracles when he was 30. That doesn't detract from the fact that he's been divine the entire time. You see, as Jesus does ministry, there's a timeline to things. And that when he does miracles, he's not just doing them to, like, show off and, like, he doesn't heal everybody who comes his way. It sounds like a terrible thing to say, but a lot of his miracles are symbolic. They point to who he is. They point to his mission. They give people a picture of who God is. So his miracles are very intentional. And you'll hear Jesus talking a lot during his ministry, now's not the time. Or Jesus knew it was the time. You hear a lot of these little references in the gospel to the idea of timing, and there's an order to the way Jesus is doing things. And so on one hand, it doesn't necessarily matter that Jesus didn't do anything for the first 30 years of his life. That does not detract from his who he is, that he's the divine Son of God. But here's where I think it does matter. If Jesus really was just a normal dude for 30 years, this gives us, like, I hope that maybe can comfort us a little bit. You know, the gospel, not the gospels, but the book of Hebrews says that Jesus sort of became human, identified us within every respect. And so for a lot of us, you know, God doesn't always feel immediate. How many angelic visions have you had? Probably not that many. And I don't want to say that God is completely silent in our lives, because I would never say that. But I maybe would use the word indirect. That the communication that we have with God, the way that he moves in his life, it's not always like fireworks from heaven. It's a lot smaller things. A little reminder through Scripture. A Christian brother or sister coming to you with a word of encouragement at the right time. A lot of times this is the way God moves. It's not in these like grand gestures. A lot of times we're not getting these prophecies of what's going to happen. Just these little interactions. God quietly moving in our lives. And there's one moment in particular I wonder about with Jesus. Because, you know, again, I don't know what Jesus knew about himself or his self-understanding. That's the deep theological question that's beyond our scope today. But it's believed by a lot of scholars that Joseph died during Jesus, somewhere during Jesus' youth, before he starts his public ministry. We don't know that for sure, but he's not mentioned at all in the Gospels. Mary is, his brothers are, his sisters are. Joseph never mentioned after Luke chapter 2. So what does that mean? Well, very likely that means that he died sometime. So can you imagine Jesus? And we'll, knowing who he is, knowing what he's been sent for, because I think there is reason to believe he knew a lot of those things. Imagine him standing next to his father's bedside when he was dying. So I'm speculating a little bit here. But I wonder what he felt. Like, did he look at his dying father and wonder why? Why does it have to be like this? Why is this happening? God, why is this happening? Was he able to look beyond that moment and say, yeah, death is not the end. I know that. Something better awaits him. So I don't honestly know the answer to that. But I take a little bit of comfort that Jesus went through that. You know, there's this moment in the one of the more recent Supermans, the one that Zack Snyder directed, where during Superman's childhood, you know, Clark Kent's childhood, his father's killed in a tornado. And there's this moment where, like, you know, Clark Kent's looking at his dad, knowing that he has the power to save his father. He's going to have to show himself and give away his identity a little bit. But his father holds up his hand like, no, it's not the time. It's just kind of this arbitrary moment because, like, why not? Just do it. But there has to be something of that, of similarity in Jesus watching Joseph die. This is the author of life. Why did anyone that he loved have to die? But he probably watched it anyway. Because we watch the people we love die, and we wonder why they have to die. So when we look at Jesus, he's not just, you know, the early church struggled more with Jesus' humanity than his divinity. The earliest heresies in the church were, like Gnosticism and others, really denied Jesus' humanity. That was the harder part for them to understand. The divinity, they seemed just to understand and accept that Jesus was divine. That Jesus was human, that was hard. Submarined their theology. So to imagine Jesus, the author of life, the Son of God, watching the man who raised him die, is a really powerful thought to me. And to think that this divine being, this Jesus, the Son of God, spent only 3 out of the 33 years of his life engaged in like miraculous deeds, that's less than 10%. And that's a lot higher than most of us get, because you know we don't see those kinds of things on a daily basis. But there are a lot of people who really expect God to do things at the snap of their fingers. That he's going to show up and save them. I'm watching this show on Netflix called The Last Kingdom. It's about 9th century England, which wasn't really England back then. There's all these other peoples, Anglo-Saxons, all that kind of stuff. And during that time, you had sort of these like Christian English Saxons, and they were interacting with a lot of pagan people around them, particularly the Vikings, the Danes, the Northmen. And you know, there's this one moment where one of the Danish, the Danish kings who've been pillaging and going over through the Saxon land, he's in a church, and he's curious about this God of the Romans, as he calls it. And so he's looking at all the crucifixes, and he looks up at heaven, and he's like, God of the Romans, if you're there, strike me down dead. And nothing happens. He's like, I thought as much. There are people, I don't think too many people have this particular view of God, but where they have this expectation that God's always going to step in a very direct way. And there are a lot of people who believe the gospel, the Bible itself is just miracle after miracle. They haven't read it. It's not. There are a lot of times when there are no miracles, when nothing supernatural is happening. It's just history of people struggling to follow and obey God and know God in this life that's often broken, that doesn't make sense a lot of times. And there, really, if you graft the miracles in the Bible, you see them concentrated in certain places, like, oh, here's Moses, we got the 10 plagues, the parting of the Red Sea, a lot of miracles. We have Elijah, a lot of miracles. But a lot of during the kings and the judges, nothing really happens. Like even David killing Goliath, is that a miracle? David killed a guy with a slingshot. Seems pretty normal to me, right? Just had good aim. It's not miraculous. He's a good slingshot person. So there's a lot of stuff in the Bible that's not miraculous. And the reason I bring this up is because I hope it shapes the idea of God that you have. Because when we have these faulty expectations of who God is, one, it can detract from our faith, but it's also very frustrating. It's very frustrating to wonder, God, why aren't you doing something here? Where are you? Why aren't you changing this situation? Why aren't you taking care of this? But to go back and look at the life of Jesus and to see, even during Jesus' life, that God may have been distant and indirect for part of it. And that's okay. You know, I'm not trying to take away anything from God's nature or his faithfulness or anything like that. I'm just telling you what I see in the scriptures, that God is a lot more indirect than we often think he is. Look at the book of Esther. Did God deliver the Israelite people when they were facing extinction? Yeah, he did. He's not even mentioned, but he did. He works through people. He works through events. That seems to be how God wants to work. And it's also an invitation to faith, to believe in him, to trust in him, despite the fact he doesn't always do the direct things that we want him to do. And so my hope today is that as you look at the life of Jesus and the unfolding history of God's redemption and human life, that you'll see who God is and how he kind of acts, so that as you look at your own life, you'll be encouraged. Because the ordinary is hard. Day after day of doing the mundane, boring things of our lives are hard. And it can take us away from God. But God is there in the midst of all of those things. He's been there. He's walked it himself. And he's redeemed these things as well. And so I hope that you can find peace as you look at your life, even as you look at your struggles and your sinks full of dirty dishes. God is there. And God's present. Let's pray. So God, I pray that you would move in our hearts today, that we would feel your grace and mercy. And really, you know, we would ask for powerful demonstrations. We would want these things, God. We would want your voice in our speaking to us. We would want you doing miraculous things. I know there are a lot of people in this church today who are waiting for you to do something miraculous and heal people. And this is not to say that you don't do those things. But help us to understand what you want from us, who you are, that we could follow you in humble obedience to be the people that you want us to be, day after day, through the mundane and the ordinary. And we ask this in Jesus' name.